Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Man, it's so good to be back. Welcome to the Bitcoin Brainstorm. I'm your host, Rod Rudy, co-founder of Bitcoin Park, a community-supported campus here in Nashville, Tennessee, focused on grassroots freedom tech adoption and a home for Bitcoiners to work, learn, collaborate, and build. We are now on episode 14. And thanks again to the support from Kathy, Yassine, and the ARK team. We're taking our monthly Bitcoin topic-based approach at Bitcoin Park and applying it to this monthly podcast series we're calling Bitcoin Brainstorm. Each month, we've covered a range of topics and invite amazing people from a variety of areas within the Bitcoin community. Our aim is simple: drive conversation around Bitcoin. And we are now here today, especially with the election next week, talking about the convergence of all these different areas, from investing, the macro implications, policy, scaling Bitcoin, and the financial tooling needed to serve 8 billion people. So we have approximately 60 minutes, and like always, we'll be covering a lot. Let me do some quick introductions, then jump right into it. And first, the Director of Digital Assets of ARK Invest and the brainchild of this monthly series is back. We missed you, my friend, Yassine Almandra. Yassine, good to see you.
Good to be back, Rod. I'm really excited about this conversation. It's awesome to be back.
I'll save your predictions for later on in the show and so on, because that should be good. Okay, next up, co-founder and managing partner of the world's leading Bitcoin technology investor, 1031, Grant Gilliam. Grant, welcome.
Hey there. Glad to be here and glad to be dialing in from Bitcoin Park in Nashville.
Let's go. And Kathy, I'm actually going to ask you about your experience at the park later on in the show, because you were here in July for pretty much the entire week, which was awesome.
Absolutely. It was awesome.
And Barry Dean, founder and CEO of Bitcoin infrastructure company Bitvora. Barry, welcome to the podcast.
Good to see you again, Rod. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Nashville does miss you too. Also joining, co-founder and CEO of Bitcoin native financial services firm Unchained Capital, Joe Kelly.
Glad to be here, dialing in from the other Nashville, Austin, Texas.
That's right. Thanks for joining us, Joe. And always, Kathy Wood, founder, CEO, and CIO at ARK Invest. Welcome back, Kathy.
Thank you so much, Rod. I'm really happy we're all here together again.
Heck yeah. And seriously, these are like a joy, putting these together and getting some of the most prominent Bitcoiners together around this Bitcoin brainstorm. So can't thank you enough. Maybe I want to kick it off, and maybe Yassine or Kathy to jump in to get this going. But Bitcoin dominance is near an all-time high. Bitcoin price is at a near an all-time high. And we have the election next week. I don't know what that's signaling. And we'll save some predictions maybe for the latter half of this episode. But yeah, let me start maybe with Kathy first to get this conversation going.
Rod, before you do jump to Kathy, Bitcoin is almost at an all-time high, but doesn't it seem like interest in Bitcoin is near lows, where there has been this slow uptick without really any press on Bitcoin's price action? And I was recently doing just Google search trends, and we're at all-time lows here. So Bitcoin's steady Eddie, all while no one's really paying attention to it. I'm curious at what the broader group might think on the dynamics in that regard.
I'll start off on that. The surprise is that the searches have been falling as the Trump campaign has been focusing more on Bitcoin. And I think even in the last few days, maybe it was over the weekend, he talked about making Bitcoin transactions tax-free. And so it was like, what? So I've been very surprised. But you know what? Just as a student of the markets, when the markets are pushing up like this and there's really no hype, there's some real demand developing somewhere. Now, maybe it is continued institutional demand as more and more people make a decision about this new asset class. Maybe it's that, and that's happening slowly but surely. And maybe we do need clarification from the election to get retail investors more excited again. I don't know. I would think that institutional investors would be somewhat cautious around an election, but something's going on behind the scenes. The searches are not there. And so it leads me to believe this is somewhat institutional in nature. Love to get other thoughts.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly on my end, my friends and family are not asking me about Bitcoin. And I remember the last two cycles, that was one of sort of the leading indicators. So no Uber drivers are talking about it, no friends and family. So I'm not noticing like any interest, at least on the retail side.
I like the, someone posted at whatever, I don't know the actual number, but the App Store ranking for Coinbase is still like down there, like past top 100 apps, you know? So just that idea that there's not this demand for downloading Coinbase and getting go from retail. And yeah, speaking for Unchained, well, it's been a good year. Great for us. I will say like, yeah, it's not like we're seeing people beating down our doors right now in an increased fashion above kind of our base rates. So we're likewise scratching our heads even this morning about like, well, you know, I mean, inbound leads is like consistent, but not what we would expect for us at or near this all-time high.
Yeah, I think the market has worn people out, you know, in this period from March to now, but also over the last couple of years, it's been, I think it's felt like a long bear market. From our lens, which is relatively unique because we're investors in about 35 different companies operating on the ecosystem, you see very positive momentum building, sort of what Joe is saying here, that the companies are doing pretty well. Actually, a lot of the companies are growing very significantly. And in some cases, what we've seen during this year is that some companies are growing well over 100% in actual revenues and generating real profits. But the interesting thing is once you peel back the layer, sort of consistent with what a lot of you are saying, is we're not seeing a massive influx in new users. You know, retail hasn't entered in. You might be seeing 10, 20% growth in new users, but the vast majority of growth being driven by volume from existing users. And that's also consistent with what I've seen just on the investor side. You know, we're constantly talking to investors and looking to raise new capital. And it just seems like this long period that we've had over the last couple of years and over the last 6 months, people sort of fallen asleep and are not paying attention. So I agree.
I think also part of that is there was this expectation that post Bitcoin halving, things would pick up really quickly. And, you know, typically there is the narrative of the halving is going to coincide with the bull market. And in reality, what we got over the summer was just a bunch of chop. And I think in many ways it purged some of the weaker holders, but leaves you in this much healthier dynamic where we see these price increases in a much more subtle way. And then obviously the ETF approval is another huge dynamic where the appetite has really shifted from more of the retail to institutional. And that has been a massive success as well. So
isn't it the case though, that like it's been a typical that's more, the all-time high is set 9 to 12 months after the halving, something like that. So for me, it kind of feels like right on time, or like, you know, or maybe par for the course on these other cycles. So it's such a scary thing, honestly, planning your business, or, you know, if I rewind 8 years ago, the start of Unchained, you know, convincing investors or talking to VCs about the lull periods between bear markets and just that, hey, all I have to do is survive. All I have to do is get through these things. So every 4 years, don't worry, you know, Bitcoin's cycle will take care of us. It felt like building the company on like astrology or, you know, I mean, it's markets, it's different. There's more here to it, but man, sure as heck, if it's not just kind of turned out that way and may it turn out again. So fool me, you know, two or three times. Like I don't know. I'm just now much more of a believer that that all-time high is around the corner.
I think there was a lot of anticipatory buying before the ETF launches and then before the halving. And so we've had the digestion of that because it has done, if you do year-to-date analysis, it's been a fabulous performing asset. And a lot of people in certainly our world are year-to-date people. That's how they think. And it's been very good. But what we're seeing now in terms of the spot Bitcoin ETFs is the flows have slowed down, but now they're becoming steady. They're becoming steady, and that, again, back to the first statement, maybe we'll have institutions, I don't know what breaks us into new high territory, but maybe it is the election, maybe that's why a lot of people are sitting on their hands and are waiting to see if, you know, who's going to win. They both seem much more crypto-friendly, Bitcoin-friendly. But clearly the Trump campaign is much more so. So that might, if he wins, it might.
Right. We should dive into that a little bit more, Kathy. I think, I mean, if the prediction markets on Polymarket are right and Trump is favored to win, you know, a lot of people are coining this as a sort of Trump pump. And I'd be curious, you know, maybe, and for the viewers as well, just taking a step back and really understanding the regulatory implications where, you know, especially for innovation broadly, you know, the Trump administration is likely to take a much more hands-off approach, much lighter touch regulation, reducing a lot of the oversight and really deregulating. You know, what are the implications, you think, for a macro asset like Bitcoin?
Well, consider the source, but I think the ramifications are going to be unbelievable for innovation. Regulations are strangling businesses, financial regulation even more so. I mean, all of the companies in our business have had to add one compliance person after another because of waves and waves of regulation post tech and telecom bust, and then even more so after 2008-09. And I know if Trump were to win, in his first administration, he basically said, if you want to put in a new regulation, then you need to take back two regulations. I think the combination of something like that, or actually just unwinding as many as possible by executive order, I don't know how many are possible that way, getting that done, getting Gensler out of the way, he will be gone. And I think he'll be gone in either administration, but especially a Trump administration. And on the FTC side, which is Federal Trade Commission, which is has taken a heavy hand in terms of preventing M&A and preventing liquidity events for venture capital firms. Grant is nodding yes, in violent agreement, yes. But we're seeing that broadly in our portfolio. By now, you know, there should be a lot of M&A activity picking up because prices have been so subdued. But they're not being allowed. They're antitrust zealots, and yet we have the Magnificent Six growing ever bigger. So there, you know, there's a huge disconnect out there. And I think if we get a Harris administration, at one point she was saying she would let Lina Khan go as well. Trump definitely will. That's the FTC. But there's a little bit of a backlash, so not sure as much about that. So it's very clear it's going to take off. It's really been held back terribly by lack of liquidity events caused by the FTC and, you know, just uncertainty generally around government regulation. So we shall see.
So, Kathy, are you going to join forces with Elon and join the Doge team to pull back those two regulations as well?
One thing we don't want is Elon to leave all of his companies because, and I don't think he will. He's going to figure this out another way. He's a great delegator, and he'll just put in some rules-based, guidelines.
Or maybe it'll create some Elon bots.
AI is going to be a big part of this. It's going to be a very big, technology is going to be a big part of it. I would imagine that government employment will go down, if for no other reason than attrition. They're not going to let. And one of the things that I'm very happy to hear Elon say is a sentence that I use all the time. Government spending is taxation. Government spending is taxation. It's either going to be paid for with taxes concurrently or in the future, or the most regressive tax at all, inflation. So Elon is saying that. I think that's going to become a mantra because it's very appealing to a lot of people. Wait a minute. You want to increase this program? You want to increase government spending? Okay, then you want to increase taxation. So I'm pretty excited about that one too.
And then monetary policy as well. I'd be curious. I mean, just applying pressure on the Fed to potentially lower interest rates and what the dynamics there could look like.
If Trump's elected and they do what they're, you know, the decreasing regulation, getting government spending down and expectations of government spending down, I believe that what we've been expecting is going to happen on steroids. And that is the five major innovation platforms that are evolving today. So robotics, energy storage, artificial intelligence, blockchain technology, and multi-omic sequencing. They're evolving. They involve 14 different technologies, and they're all ready for prime time. They're entering exponential growth trajectories. You know that from what we all do. They will be allowed to fly. Now, why will they? Because technologies are inherently deflationary. So, and why is that? They deliver huge gains in productivity. And so can you imagine a world where unit growth accelerates and pricing is either flat or negative? Maybe you don't get it too negative because services take a long time to adjust, but that is Goldilocks. That the market seems to be building that outlook into the multiple structure, the valuation, because this is hugely positive for valuations, long rates staying low, inverted yield curve. So if unit growth goes up, you'll have short rates at times above long rates, but not for recessionary reasons. It's because the unit growth dynamics are so powerful, but long rates are quiescent because inflation isn't an issue. So this is what it was like in the early 1900s, actually the last time we had private money. Now, back then, it was much more of a boom-bust world. The Fed didn't come into being until 1913. So I think, we have more competition for fiat currencies now. Thank you, Bitcoin. It's also going to be a warning for monetary authorities. Watch out. You're looking at competition here, and look at what gold's doing now. So I think there's a worry. Gold is worried about the election. People are worried about inflationary ramifications. That's what they keep saying. But if we're right, the opposite's going to happen.
Totally. So maybe we go to the, I'm actually curious from Barry's point of view, from an infrastructure side. So we go from all this adoption and demand from your infrastructure building this out. Is there anything that's worrisome for you as you're building this Bitcoin infrastructure company, or some things that you're super bullish on?
Yeah, well, a few things. Just to sort of circle back on the regulations, like I think if governments are sending signals to us that, hey, we support your industry, we're not, the anti-crypto army trying to throw you in jail, it actually encourages entrepreneurs to take a shot. You don't necessarily have to go raise $1 million, hire a whole bunch of lawyers, and get a different license in every state. You can try your small little idea, whether it's a rewards app or accepting payments on e-commerce, as an example. So I think as long as we like sort of have that signal. Now, we haven't had in the US, but many countries around the world, they don't take the same approach as the US, where they're sort of regulating by enforcement, where you actually like they haven't clearly defined the rules. But if you break a rule that they haven't said, you might go to jail. Not every country is like that. So I think, you know, America being such an innovative country, our industry has been held back tremendously by this sort of signal that we have had. So, I don't know too much about whether or not you can believe what these politicians are saying, but I think if we do take them at their word, then we'll see more companies actually take that chance. And then companies like Bitvora, we just make it really easy for them. So now, not only do you not have to go and hire a bunch of like compliance people, you also have new infrastructure companies that make it very easy to just get started right away.
A slightly different take I would have, at least, though, is I do think something of the, as an entrepreneur, I partly chose to work in Bitcoin because of how much I thought a lot of the consensus view would be, oh, it's too hard, or it's difficult, or the regulatory uncertainty. Like, it keeps, I don't know, competition at bay, or makes the hurdle to being successful like just different. And so you just have to maybe be a different minded entrepreneur to kind of blast through those things. I think even in some of the markets like Switzerland, I was just at the Plan B conference, and it's great. I mean, it's an exciting place, but almost because of the regulatory certainty that's there, like you have these Swiss banks like Signum and these others, but I mean, it's relatively boring. There's not a lot of innovation happening there. I mean, it's great. It's like, they get to do both Bitcoin and banking together, but you know, in a sleepy, well-regulated, like really clear kind of way. So, I mean, some of the constraints here do force the real entrepreneurship and the innovation. And then, I think kind of unpacking what sort of regulatory changes could happen post either administration. My interest, or what I think it's less even on specific regulations, because thankfully as a Bitcoin company, SEC or who's in charge of it, thankfully hasn't had to affect us. Like we raise money, we raise capital under securities regulations that are very old and very, you know, well understood and very, you know, somewhat reasonable. Just the exemptions we can get to raise securities are fine. And I do think the MTL regime is odd. I get parts of it. Parts of it like are deserving to be there when we're custodying or holding client funds. But it is very odd apparatus for kind of how we go about selling Bitcoin or trading Bitcoin with clients. But I do think that the changes that can happen are for back to just the banks here in the country, that at least with a different administration on top that sets a different tone and can allow more bank capital, bank participation in the industry. But that's kind of more of the game changer that I would see in the next year or two as those market participants can participate in lending, just actually providing more banking services to people in the space freely and without concern. And then hopefully you're working with Barry on infrastructure projects, or actually becoming like customers or opening up markets like that in the existing regulated institutions here.
I mean, from my seat, investing in some of this underlying technology, I think it's going to be interesting to see if it plays out as Kathy's saying. She's sort of saying, like, depending on some of these drivers, you might see a real ignition of productivity and deflationary movements. And then that points to bullishness for Bitcoin. You know, on the other hand, you see people like Paul Tudor Jones and Stanley Druckenmiller, you know, warning about potential inflation that's going to be coming over the long term, and either outright saying that they don't own any treasuries or that they're shorting treasuries, and that all roads sort of lead to inflation in their mind. But if it goes down that path, that also sort of points to bullishness for Bitcoin. And so from my seat, I just think that like it's really interesting that not many people have connected the dots yet, that if either option is bullish for Bitcoin, what does that mean about the underlying infrastructure and the companies that are building, you know, the technology to allow, you know, the next wave of people and institutions and even governments get access to Bitcoin, hold it securely, use it, and make it easier. That to me, I think, is a bullish signal no matter which way it goes.
Joe, you mentioned a convergence between you and Barry. Can you unpack that a little bit? Maybe dive a little bit deeper into, you know, what you guys are doing at Unchained with collaborative custody and Barry at Bitvora. kind of on the API and node management side. Where's that convergence? We always like to think about convergence. I'd be curious as.
After you answer that, I'd be curious to know from Grant's perspective too, because of those 35 portfolio companies, how many of them are like converging on each other as well and building on top of that, which is pretty cool.
I'll take a first stab, at least. So, I mean, with the thesis being for Unchained, that our business is built on serving the financial services needs of long-term Bitcoin holders. And so that in a way, we're seeking that direct relationship with the Bitcoin holders themselves, as are our customers. And backing from a kind of, you know, slightly contrarian or otherwise a thesis that says regulations or other things will be too much in the way of traditional institutions doing this themselves. So we got to go straight at it for the customers. And then that way we've kind of had to be something, you know, somewhat vertically integrated in our approach between the technology stack that we deliver our services through and how that connects to Bitcoin and the Bitcoin blockchain. So we deliver those services through a collaborative custody means. Our clients get to hold their own keys to the Bitcoin to help them secure. And that key ownership, they also participate in holding their keys when they, you know, get, for instance, take the collateral as a loan from us. They're holding one key out of three to their Bitcoin collateral for the duration of the loan. So that theme is kind of there through us. And that's also, I think it puts us on the other side of a lot of the innovator's dilemma that traditional institutions will face when most of their business model is invested around asset capture, or holding the assets in a full custody manner. So it kind of puts us outside of those traditional incentives that are there in a way we kind of get to innovate early on earning that customer relationship and then developing the suited technologies towards the delivery of the product. And I think there's ways in the longer run, as maybe institutions want some of what we have here from a technical capabilities, we can find ways to white label or sell through to them. But I think that might be some of the convergence, or where Barry could speak to, at least where, you know, when maybe the institution will wake up sooner, you know, and want APIs or API ready capabilities to build on top of Bitcoin faster. And that might be where Bit4 comes in.
Yeah, like I think Bitcoin has done a pretty good job of proving itself being a very useful savings technology. Like, people who have saved in Bitcoin have done very well, but it hasn't proven whether or not it's a useful medium of exchange. And the Bitcoin blockchain itself is not very good at moving around. You know, it's slow, it's expensive. But there are new emerging technologies coming out. So that's, you know, we call them layer twos, like the Lightning Network. There's one aptly named Arc, and some others. So these are coming out. And what Bit4 is really trying to do is, okay, you've done this great job saving your money with Unchained. They kept it really nice and safe with you, but now maybe you want to spend it. Maybe now you want to move it around. But it's difficult to do that. Like, whether you have to run your own node or understand deeply sort of all of this new emerging technology. So what Bit4 is trying to do is take a traditional developer that makes apps for things outside of Bitcoin. They understand APIs. They're already working with them. They don't know what blockchains are or how they work or cryptography. So what we're trying to do is, like, after you've sort of saved all your money, now you have it, what do you do with it? Do you just sell it, or do you subscribe to these streaming podcasts? Do you receive payments on your website now in Bitcoin versus taking a credit card? So really just like getting that Bitcoin moving, putting them on rails and making it super easy is at least like our thesis of what the next 10 years of Bitcoin will look like, because it is already proven. Like, the numbers are in. Bitcoin is an excellent savings technology. But can it actually be a good medium of exchange? I think time will still tell on that one.
Barry, from a monetary standpoint, I'd be curious on your thoughts on the savings versus spending technology, because in many ways, a lot of people don't want to fall into the being the Bitcoin pizza guy, where there still is a lot of room for Bitcoin to grow. And as a savings technology, you know, how do you think about the difference between the evolution of Bitcoin as a money, where ultimately, as real capital flows are injected into the network, volatility subsides, and it reaches saturation, with this being like a technological hindrance?
I actually don't believe that people are too scared of being the Bitcoin pizza guy, because, I mean, if I would have bought that pizza for $20, I could just spend in Bitcoin and then replace it, which is a saying in the Bitcoin community, you know, spend and replace. But I think, just if we imagine hypothetically that the US dollar and Bitcoin perfectly maintain their value. Of course, that's not true at all, but let's just imagine that is true. Bitcoin on its merits of, like, let's say we compare it to a wire transfer. You know, you send a wire transfer on a Friday, you're probably paying a $20 or $30 fee. It takes several days, several business days. You don't know the status of it. Versus, let's say, a Bitcoin payment, which could be settled instantly, nearly free on the Lightning Network, and you have a payment proof available to you right away. So just on the merits of its utility as a medium of exchange, I already see it as more valuable. And then on the business side, so, like, maybe less so for consumers, but certainly on the business side, if you are receiving Bitcoin, you're saving a lot of money right off the bat, whether that's credit card fees, your money is settling faster, you're not, the transactions aren't being reversed for you. You know, a lot of people don't know that, like, all this credit card fraud that happens, it's the merchants that eat all of it. The banks don't lose money, the consumer doesn't lose money, it's the businesses that lose all the money. So this is very compelling to them. And then in addition to that, like, just if I've been receiving Bitcoin all year, assuming that Bitcoin continues to go up in price, even if it's more modest going forward, this actually does increase your profit margins. Like, if I had to hold on to the cash all year and then it inflated 5-6%, that could be my entire profit margin gone just to inflation in a single year. So I think we do have a bit of a chicken and an egg situation where it's like, you know, consumers can't really spend their Bitcoin because businesses don't accept it. But why would a business spend all this time investing into having payments, like receiving payment infrastructure, if so few customers are willing to part ways with their Bitcoin? So I think just, like, making this UX a lot easier, making the technology really accessible to everyone will really sort of create a positive feedback loop in this.
So Barry, if you look at in the US, small business optimism or sentiment is down at 08-09 lows. They are in great pain. And we know that when businesses or consumers are afraid or in great pain, they are willing to change their behavior. Are you seeing that at all? This would be the environment to kickstart that, I think, based on what you just said.
So unfortunately, we are not seeing that. It's been pretty steady, I would say. So I've been in the sort of, like, Bitcoin payments space for about 5 years, and we do see small growth every year. So say you ran an e-commerce store and you accepted both credit card and Bitcoin. A few years ago, maybe 0.5% of your sales would be in Bitcoin. And then a year later, it's like 1.5% or so. And now we're seeing it's, you know, it's approaching 3. So it's slowly but steadily, it's increasing. But we do see during bull runs, it does increase a lot and then it drops off. So, you know, I wish I could say that it was picking up, but it's not really that fast from what we're seeing.
Do you not think that that's still, and I go back and forth with this, I totally agree, like, Bitcoin's dual role as a saving and spending vehicle is really just reshaping traditional financial behavior. That's really the epitome of financial sovereignty if you can collapse the two. And so in theory, that makes a lot of sense to me, but I go back and forth. Do you not think that part of the reason why we are seeing, not necessarily where we're seeing a slowdown or not an uptick in Bitcoin as a payment is because of its volatility? I say that, you know, when you compare it, for instance, to stable coins, and I'd be curious if any of you I'll have a take on it, but we've seen an explosion of growth in stablecoins and this tokenized fiat, where people still are more comfortable holding, you know, USD, and it's just because of its relative stability. And we're seeing a lot of companies like Stripe integrating with stablecoins after attempting to do that with Bitcoin 6 years ago and failing. Am I missing something here relative to just Bitcoin's volatility is a hindrance?
I don't know. I wonder, actually, because your comment was about whether it's actually changing psychology. And I mean, I might posit that psychology hasn't changed. Like, psychology is still there. It's kind of it's just clearly still a dominant saving psychology for Bitcoin. It's saving investment psychology. And I don't spend my savings on coffee. I may make a later, larger financial decision to spend, you know, household savings on, you know, a home purchase or something other that's like a bigger kind of commitment or a bigger flow, but it's doing damn well at the say. I'm not ready to fire it as a job and in a savings for our household. And you know, coffee or like those other small expenditures, those are just not something I spend savings on.
I think a big component of this is that if you rely on the Bitcoin blockchain as your payment technology, it's actually just bad. Like the user experience is just bad. So what we really needed was the Lightning Network. So we can have those instant low fee payments. But most people, they interface with their Bitcoin, you know, through their exchange or through Cash App or something. So most apps, most exchanges, they actually do not support the Lightning Network. A lot of them have to invest so much time and energy into supporting, you know, 1,000 different dog tokens that they can't go deep into the Bitcoin technology. So that's like a major gap in the market that we notice. So we just want to make it easy for them. Like any company, just a couple of lines of code with an API, boom, you have the Lightning Network and you don't have to know anything. So we're hoping that will change and that it's not because of volatility. It's actually because of complexity, but we'll see.
Barry, what about Yassine's comment on stablecoins? I mean, they have exploded. Do you think that is one of the reasons that the Bitcoin movement hasn't evolved in the way that you have expected?
I don't really think so. But I have to, you know, I have to always check myself. You know, I'm very deep in the Bitcoin world. And there aren't stable coins on Bitcoin right now. And a lot of the stable coins are happening on different chains, which are faster. And people have this understanding that, hey, you know, like Solana or Ethereum is faster than Bitcoin. So I'll just use that. And it has stable coins, whereas Bitcoin didn't have that. And they don't know about the Lightning Network. So I sort of see it from that perspective. But in my view, you know, Satoshi didn't build Bitcoin to move fiat currencies around. You know, we're here to try to replace a fundamentally unsound system. So I'm hoping that we can build a system that works on Bitcoin for payments without any use of stable coins.
So Barry, going from 0.5% to 3%, that's in 5 years, that's actually pretty fast. You know, slowly, then all at once is the mantra out there. You know, as you cross 5% and get towards 10, that's when you see real momentum, real, you know, conversations and momentum accelerating.
Well, we certainly hope so. You know, we're going to be here for the ride, but for now it's slow and steady.
And relative to the portfolio companies that you're taking a look at, I'd be curious on, you know, Bitcoin as a payments technology versus Bitcoin as a savings technology. What is your thesis there? Has that evolved given kind of the discussions that we just had?
One good example you could point to is with Strike. You know, we're the largest investor in Strike, the lead investor there. And a couple years ago, you'll probably remember that Jack Mallers was up on stage talking about how, you know, Bitcoin was going to be this, you know, that Strike was going to offer these merchant services to help Whole Foods and others accept Bitcoin. And the market just wasn't there for that at the time. And where we really have seen product market fit right now is just in giving access to Bitcoin. I think at some point there will obviously be increased adoption of Bitcoin as a payments mechanism, but actually if you hold Bitcoin and you want to take advantage of the value that you hold in Bitcoin and make payments, you can do that. I mean, you can pay with Bitcoin, or it's very easy to just exchange from Bitcoin to dollars nearly instantly. And make payments. So I think that in some sense, like this obsession over like, are people paying for coffee right now with Bitcoin or not? I think it's maybe exaggerated. I think that adoption is continuing. There is increased demand for Bitcoin as we see in the Bitcoin price. In terms of how we think about just from an investment perspective, like where do we put our dollars? What do we invest behind? I think, you know, we often say there's this order of operations, and I don't know what the level of Bitcoin adoption is right now globally, but it's very small. Is it 1%? Is it less or is it more? I don't know, but there's tremendous amount more that will be entering the market and wanting access to it. So that is a theme that we invest heavily behind, is just, you know, the quote, you know, on and off ramps like a strike that has, you know, operations in 100 countries and more money transmitter licenses than Coinbase, et cetera, et cetera. It's companies that make it easier for people to hold their Bitcoin securely, like an Unchained. You know, there's an order of operation for these building blocks of infrastructure. We invest across the space. So there's companies that are doing Lightning stuff, payments stuff, but I think it just takes time. And I think that we actually are scaling quite well. And, you know, if we're just patient, like, it will continue as it should go. As more people see the value in Bitcoin and have the need to hold a currency that isn't debased and can't be censored, more people will come in and, you know, capitalists will spring up and provide the services that those users and holders of Bitcoin will demand.
I totally agree with that. I think, I mean, capital flows are really the ultimate signal for adoption with Bitcoin. That's how Bitcoin ultimately scales. And there still is a massive gap between what we think Bitcoin's long-term value could look like and where we are today, right? Bitcoin's at $1.5 trillion of market capitalization. You compare that to gold at, you know, $15 trillion. You know, if you really think that this is the ultimate savings vehicle, I think there still is, to your point, Grant, that order of operations where accessibility, education, just clean exposure to Bitcoin as a savings vehicle is probably where you're going to see kind of critical mass and where most of the kind of interesting opportunities, you know, today lie. But that being said, if you in tandem, you can have some sort of mechanism to abstract the complexity of Bitcoin's base layer and the L2s and the payments layer, and ultimately allow for enterprises to plug and play, like that, those two aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. So I definitely see both sides of the argument.
I remember going to a conference where there were a lot of core developers in 2019, and I remember this has a little bit of deja vu here as we're talking, but the environment's very different. Back then, 2019, Bitcoin seemed stuck at $7,000, right? I remember leaving the conference, some of the core developers agreed that the worst thing that could happen to them is that Bitcoin does nothing. It just stays around $7,000. And of course, we're 10 times that now. And now we're talking about volatility preventing. You know, slowly, then all at once.
Acknowledging that narrative shift. And the same thing goes for, you know, the ECB recently publishing their piece on the wealth distribution effects of Bitcoin. Where 5 years ago, they were talking about Bitcoin being for criminal activity, and 5 years before that it was nothing but a Ponzi scheme. So there is certainly that acknowledgement of the evolution of the narrative is so sound, and oftentimes it's just, we kind of just need to be patient in many ways. And that's a great point, Kathy. I totally agree with that.
One of the things that I think a lot about is the sentiment is shifting from retail and investment from retail to institutional. And actually, the Bitcoin Policy Institute, right before we jumped on, released a paper, The Case for Bitcoin as a Strategic Reserve Asset. So, Kathy, you made a comment like, where is this next influx of capital potentially coming in into the Bitcoin ecosystem? You know, I'm curious from this group, is it a good the pros and cons, kind of steel man it, shifting from retail, grassroots, a bit more towards institutional, and then potentially to nation states adopting at large scale? Is this good for Bitcoin? I'm just curious.
Can I update you on one thing? This happened yesterday, I think. The CFO of Florida basically took note that Michigan and Wisconsin have Bitcoin on their balance sheets. They said small, and they put out a call for a study. You know, this makes sense, and especially given Florida's position against CBDCs. So they were very much against those, and I think helped derail any movement that was developing there. But now this idea that, oh, wait a minute, these other states are doing this. We're a progressive state. I think you're going to see more of it. I really do. And I think on one of the Bitcoin brainstorms, we mentioned that we had been approached by state treasurers. Well, now I think that it's a, you know, and Michigan, I can say this because they disclose it, they own ARK's spot Bitcoin ETF. You know, and then Wisconsin, I'm not sure if they do or not. They probably own another one. But the idea that a CFO of a state is saying, wait a minute, we need to look at this. What's going on here? And it was almost like an all hands on deck moment for him. So very interesting.
The individual comprises the institution. So when you have these individuals that are personally invested in Bitcoin that have seen it grow, ultimately, you know, once they get that personal allocation, they become an evangelist themselves, and then that's kind of how you get that's how you get institutional adoption. Joe, from your perspective, how are you guys seeing your clients shift as you're pushing through with the collaborative custody model? Is it really more the high net worth individual, or are you starting to see a real shift in institutional adoption as well?
Our bread and butter continually is a high net worth person, kind of mass affluent and up kind of profile, who, while I don't know, maybe on the order of 10 to 20% of our clients in a given month are kind of brand new or acquiring some of their first Bitcoin, we're not. Usually they're on ramp. We live later in the funnel for someone's Bitcoin journey where they've already acquired the Bitcoin or some initial stack through a Cash App, Strike, or River, or Coinbase, or any other platform, and then they start to they're really invested in. They want to hold it for the longer term, and then now you have the challenges of like, well, how do you want to upgrade your security, especially as the asset grows in value, and how do you want to solve for issues around inheritance or financial planning, or the kinds of things that the questions that arise from holding something for a decade or more. I would say we've barked up some trees to try to serve institutions more. I think quite like the product mix or the positioning for Unchained is just not as suited as a Fidelity or how a Coinbase, you know, could walk through those same doors and have a brand value proposition most around the brand and around the kind of one throat to choke, if you will, for that kind of a setup. So it's not shifted with Unchained. It's just kind of more of the same, which is great. You want, you know, a healthy business has good like-for-like customers that you can serve well and grow through their own existing networks and on a referral basis. So that's just kind of continues to be the lifeblood for Unchained. And yeah, but I see that kind of that going forward, that's going to continue.
If I could jump in and tell a couple quick stories, especially around the park. It is actually a really funny, or not funny. Every kind of bull market, you'll find people knocking on our door or knocking on any of our respective doors and being like, hey, I really need to get my Bitcoin off this exchange because it's now worth something. So it's really been awesome because we have a couple Unchained employees here at the park, and to see them huddling around some of these older folks and maybe younger folks and really helping them kind of get set up in this collaborative custody model, and then potentially eventually, you know, custodying themselves and so on. But always surprising behavior in any of these upticks, especially when the price starts ripping.
What's interesting too, something come up for me when thinking about like the state adoption angle. I mean, every now and then the narrative, you know, rises and falls around like, you know, ossification versus a more liberal approach to the protocol. And it's kind of occurring to me too about like those kind of state level decisions about this, the state of Florida or potentially future government of the United States. And honestly, it made me put a lot more credence in my mind to like kind of the ossification argument, right? Like, because those people make allocation decisions based on certainty of what this asset is. And so I was just like thinking compared to like, in their mindset, the way something as changing and, you know, reshaping as like an Ethereum or something else otherwise looks like, might as well just be a venture bet or VC kind of investment versus the kind of narrative that really gets to cohere and line up and allow like the meme of Bitcoin, through your point, Yassine, enter in through the internal champion, the person that, you know, believes it enough to like personally advocate, and then the, like the investment committees and decision-making bodies in these places just having a lot of certainty about what they're getting. So I know that's its own potential rabbit hole, some of that path of, you know, protocol governance and debates, but I was like, yeah, that God bless those, online advocates and people have argued vociferously for not changing a thing in some regard, even though we do try to get more things that we need on the infrastructure side.
You mean those crypto anarchists, like Michael Saylor called them out as?
Paranoid.
Those honey badgers.
Paranoid crypto anarchists.
Yeah.
Just a quick point on the pros and cons. We have a saying that everything is good for Bitcoin. But the question is it good for people who don't have Bitcoin? Traditionally, retail investors have had the edge where they could front run the institutions. You know, they weren't allowed to buy Bitcoin. If everyone starts rushing in and gets in before the individuals, that's potentially non-ideal. But I think the other thing that, you know, like these ETFs are buying Bitcoin, but they're buying it on behalf of individuals and their 401ks and whatnot, right? It's not like it's the companies owning all the Bitcoin. They're just on behalf of others. And I think the last I checked, like the ETFs are approaching 1 million coins that they own. I think if you add up the public companies, I shouldn't do math live, but I think it's another 1 million or so. So still the vast majority of Bitcoin is held by individuals by a wide margin. And I think that's a great thing. And if institutions need to get a little piece to participate in this great Bitcoin world, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's one of the many beautiful things about Bitcoin is how it was distributed. It was distributed quickly, very early on. And so people like Michael Saylor, who've been doing his hardest over years and years and taking on debt and buying billions and billions, all of that effort, he still only has 1% of the supply. So I think it's very hard. Like what most people are concerned about is, does it create some sort of centralization of coins? And does that change the risk dynamic? It seems like that's just going to be a very tough thing. And as like, I don't know if it's good or bad, the institutions, I just think it's inevitable, right? Like if we're right about Bitcoin, it's going to be held by institutions. The vast majority of the wealth is tied up in some of these groups. Like your favorite, you know, supervillain is going to own Bitcoin, and that just is what it is. And it will be hard for there to be significant concentration without there being a massive appreciation in value that benefits the individuals that are already holding it.
Right. That's the thing, is that they're going to be buying from strong holders. And so there's, I think, ultimately an arms race to accumulate as much Bitcoin as possible, that people are going to have that realization at an institutional level. But really, to your point, Grant, like there's no other asset or asset class with the adoption curve dynamics that Bitcoin had, where you had it completely distributed open source software, really for hobbyists and enthusiasts and those passionate about the cyberpunk ideology. And no institution was going to touch that. And usually in traditional asset classes, those dynamics are completely reversed, right? Where you think about like venture as a great example. And Kathy, we have strong stances on the whole accredited investor dynamic. But it's usually you have the institutions that have these high barriers where it makes retail very difficult to penetrate. With Bitcoin, it's the exact opposite. And I don't know, Kathy, if you want to touch a little bit on, our thesis on just accredited investors and what we're trying to do at ARK relative to that.
Yeah. First, I'll just, echo what Barry said, though. You know, the institutionalization means a lot more people will have exposure to Bitcoin. ETFs, they are probably half and half retail and institutional now. I'm not quite sure the numbers turn around, change. But then you've got, the retirement accounts, that's pensions and so forth. They too are buying the ETFs, these state pension plans, they are representing people who now have exposure. So that's an interesting way to look at it. And yeah, in terms of the reason we started a venture fund, or among the reasons, was, you know, the question we were getting from our clients is, wait a minute, why is it typically a young investor who's passionate about technology, and knows a lot about technology and knows a lot about all of these private companies that venture capital is funding, why is it that I'm prevented from getting a shot at those? I know more than the about that company than the people investing in that company. And that's not fair, just because I don't make enough money or I'm not wealthy enough. And so our venture capital is in the form of an interval fund. We don't take carry because we wanted to. And you know, in describing it, I was beginning to feel this is not American, what's going on out there. It's just not. And, you know, democratization, I think one of the reasons we do this Bitcoin brainstorm is to talk a lot about democratization and freedom and freedom of choice. So
100%. Not to bring it back to the election, we've been running for an hour now. So I thought a fun way maybe to kind of near the end of this is, this will be published again on Monday, knock on wood. And then the next time we do this brainstorm, we'll either have a new president. Well, we're going to definitely have a new president, whether it's the same regime or a new regime. From a Bitcoin lens, you know, and maybe I'll start with Grant and then everyone interject. I'm just curious, what does the future of Bitcoin hold from your vantage point as like a leader in your respective Bitcoin industry?
Man, that's such a tough question to answer. But I guess what I would say, what I'm excited about is coming back to the point I was making earlier that I think all roads are sort of pointing towards Bitcoin, no matter which direction we go here. And that's bullish, I think, on the companies that are building the underlying infrastructure. I'm very excited to see as Bitcoin continues to enter the mainstream, that some of the Bitcoin companies also enter the mainstream. We have Fold, which is one of our investments. They announced that they would be going public via SPAC, which they announced, you know, a few months ago. I'm excited to see things like that happen. We've got some really exciting things happening in our portfolio, and that's not the only one. We've got some other lightning bolts and bottled up that I'm very excited to see happen. And I think that will, you know, there'll be some fireworks into 2025.
Speaking of Fold, a quick tangent before I pass it to Barry. One of the best ways to stack Bitcoin is with Fold. I used to travel so much for work back in the day. I used to fly, stay in hotels and so on. So I used to maximize those credit card reward points. Now I just maximize Bitcoin rewards points. So I maximize my Fold purchases. I got my interest-bearing account now with River that gets me Bitcoin on my cash. I pay and use Bitcoin and then I get rewarded on that. So I have this like whole personal circular reward system that I've implemented now that just stacks sats for me. And I actually do see in terms of the future, I do see to Grant's point on the adoption curve as well as Barry's point. On the individual side, I think it just becomes slowly more mainstream. It's like when you're playing these online games or doing whatever, why earn, like it's actually from the corporate world. I now think these like hotel points and air miles points are like wacky to me because they can just change the game at any given point. But they can't change the sats when I earn those sats. So I can see a world where these, even the young kids are saying, hey, I'm playing this game. You know, you're giving me Robux points. I get it. Why can I only spend it within your own ecosystem? Can you give me the sats or the Bitcoin such that I can go spend it on gift cards over here or buy those pair of shoes over there? So I could see that, you know, going from your 3% adoption curve, 5% to Kathy's point where all of a sudden we're, you know, going parabolic and so on. But curious your thoughts, Barry.
Yeah, well, you know, disclosure, we're a Canadian company. I'm Canadian, but we are very interested in what's happening in the election, and we wish you guys all the best next week on that. But just in terms of like the future of Bitcoin, I was thinking about this last night. You know, I'm dating myself a little bit, but I remember when the internet was coming out and most people didn't have a computer and they didn't subscribe to the internet. And it was not at all obvious that the internet was going to do what it was going to do, right? Because, you know, I got my newspapers and who's going to spend thousands of dollars on a computer, you know? Like, I'll just go to the library. But to me, Bitcoin is so much more obvious of a replacement to legacy finance. Like, just all the incentives are there. The utility is there. It is just so incredibly obvious. So for me, like, the future of Bitcoin is so exciting. We just have to, the hardest part is being patient. But, you know, one thing that Bitcoiners do sort of better than everyone else is being patient. So I'm incredibly excited. And yeah, just practicing being patient over here.
How about you, Joe?
Excitement's there. I mean, I do think just both as like a digitally native currency, I mean, some of that naturalness of seeing it is there for a lot of the younger generation. But I think the older generation, a lot of like where Unchained's most significant, you know, months for client growth have often unfortunately been on the heels of like Calamity or like FTX failure, or a lot of you know, industry activity in 2020 was spawned by questions raised while we're all at home, spending much time on the internet about a money printer. What is that? We have, where's money come from? And then like just the literal, just like the Google search or like the self, you know, education path that a lot of people went through is what brought people to the space. So I do think for kind of a lot of the older generation, I do think it's harder. Doesn't disagree with you, Barry, but like, it's just like for some people, Bitcoin's not obvious. So like, it's not obvious what's wrong with their money until something hits you in the face. Your bank, you know, doesn't let you wire your money out, or there's a bank failure kind of a thing, and there's something happening with the system that like points to these cracks. So that's just always there, and that's. I think even wrapping around some of the election stuff is hard. Well, at least on an administration like policy standpoint, you could put side by side and see, you know, Trump has more, you know, like points or things add up. I think either way though, I think Bitcoin's values, it's the amount of like truth and ongoing relevance of it it's gonna kind of win either way, or it's got the force of good, you know, behind it, or it's like God's currency or something like that, you know, as far as I'm concerned. And so just from an American values point of view and what's going to win over the long run, Bitcoin's like a much longer term thing than like who's president or which party is in power today.
I think we're on the precipice talking about narrative evolution from, you know, Bitcoin being established as a unique asset class to Bitcoin being established, as Rod and Grant said, as a mainstream asset class. And I think with this upcoming election, you know, and institutional adoption, institutional investors basically incorporating it as a default to their portfolio, we're now entering a phase where Bitcoin becomes this mainstream asset class. So that's what I'm most looking forward to in 2025. In addition to hopefully seeing, you know, more balanced regulation, I think governments around the world are now competing on figuring out ways to balance consumer protection with fostering innovation. And so Bitcoin is no longer something that can be just swept under the rug. And it's really entering the mainstream as a legitimate asset class.
I'll just go here, Rod, segue, kind of saying adding an exclamation point to what Yassin just said. I think the more that, you know, we hear people we would not have expected to talk about Bitcoin, like these state treasurers or pension funds, and the more you hear the next administration, they both say they're crypto friendly, one will be more aggressive than the other, but the more that kind of news gets out, the more I think the rest of the world is going to pay attention, and you know, there's going to be a very virtuous feedback loop, and you know, people, this is legitimizing for, I mean, we're the world's reserve currency, and here's our government doing this. And so, sure, to some people out there, it's going to be okay. then you know, the dollar's still strong relative to anything, but this is an important fallback. I'm going to do that too instead of my currency.
Totally. I was just thinking about it. You know, we kicked this brainstorm off talking about our anecdotal conversations, and it feels like there's this calm before the storm. Actually, tonight we're hosting about 30 or 40 Vanderbilt college students for a Bitcoin night with a number of our folks. Well, this is our second annual doing this. And the first time we did it, we only had five or six. So 30 to 40 now is a nice little uptick. And then also thinking about, like, you know, Kathy, you mentioned the state treasurers and so on, you know, here in Nashville specifically, our Chamber of Commerce CEO, Ralph Schultz, has been talking about Bitcoin and Bitcoin Park. Our Commissioner Stuart McCorder of the Economic Development, you know, every chance he gets is very kind. He talks about Bitcoin and Bitcoin Park, and, you know, may not get the publicity or, like, you know, in our, and maybe Uber drivers and so on, but some of these very influential people and industry leaders amongst our communities and state communities, I could see this as the next, you know, in the future of what Bitcoin holds for the next epoch, at least, could be a pretty massive uptick. So, as Barry said, I'm, and all of us, I believe, extremely bullish on what's to come. This has been fantastic. We're well over an hour. I know we could do this for like a couple of hours. So I can't thank you all enough for you guys' time. And hopefully you guys join us next time. So thank you so much, everybody.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.
Bitcoin is a relatively new asset class, and the market for Bitcoin is subject to rapid changes and uncertainty. Bitcoin is largely unregulated, and Bitcoin investments may be more susceptible to fraud and manipulation than more regulated investments. Bitcoin is subject to unique and substantial risks, including significant price volatility, lack of liquidity, and theft. Bitcoin is subject to rapid price swings, including as a result of actions and statements by influencers and the media, changes in the supply and demand of Bitcoin, and other factors. There is no assurance that Bitcoin will maintain its value over the long term. ARK strongly encourages any investor considering an investment in Bitcoin or any other digital asset to consult with a financial professional before investing. All statements made regarding Bitcoin are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and or podcast guests and are not recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold Bitcoin. Historical results are not indications of future results.